105 FM and online at WBAI.org.
I am WBAI GM Bertol Reimers. Our on-air campaign starts in May, and we're asking you to visit give2wbai.org and give a sustainer pledge now and become a BAI buddy. It's an easy and convenient way for you to support the programs you know and love. You can also shorten the upcoming fund drive with your contribution. No matter how much you pledge to give as a BAI buddy, you know you are always doing your part. Giving now at give2wbai.org during the month of April will help your community. Please help now. This is WBAI New York.
Got questions about your computer?
Mm-hmm.
Want to know about the latest electronics?
Yeah.
Are you confused by high-definition TV?
A little.
Well, tune into WBAI every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for the Personal Computer Show.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's every Wednesday on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Oh.
So why don't you tell a friend?
Well, okay.
And tell your boss.
Well.
Hey, call your mom and tell them about the Personal Computer Show every Wednesday at 8 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Oh, okay.
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not...
This May Day, workers are building bridges. Sunday, May 1st from 3 to 6 p.m. from live rallies celebrating those who do the work. And we'll crisscross the country to bring you the movers and shakers who are putting the movement back into the labor movement. Building Bridges reveals the soul of the working class, the poetry of organizing, and power of workers to make another world possible. Sunday, May 1st, 3 to 6 p.m., Building Bridges May Day Special. Where else? Over WBAI and 9.5 FM.
Arab Spring, 1 billion rising. Freedom schools, the maroons, rebellion thriving. We've been rising since the dawn of creation, sun. In the blood of our veins, liberation runs. From Muhammad Ali to Sunniata and Asada, Nogoreta Menchu, and Nkrumah to Zapata, Mahatma Gandhi, Iko Madre's daughters, and every activist of the global intifada. From lunch counters.
And you are listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, where the time is just about 7 p.m., and it is time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
Of every person at Pepsi Cola are with you.
I got fired by my boss, Pepsi.
We have to look great for Pepsi Cola.
I nailed Jesus to the cross, Pepsi.
Well, you gotta pay the price.
Powdered mashed potatoes in the cupboard for 3 years. Alcoholic husband driving. Okay. Wives to tears. everything still tastes the same.
Think again.
Pepsi.
Very good evening to you. The program is Off the Hook. Rob T. Firefly here with you in WBAI's studio. And I'm joined in said studio by Mike.
Happy Wednesday.
And we're joined on the telephone by Bernie S.
Greetings from Philadelphia.
And you were listening to an extended intro. The tune was The Greatest Taste Around by Negative Land with Richard Dwayne Lyons on vocals. Richard Lyons, one of the founding members of Negative Land, it's very sad for us to report that he has passed away. So I thought I'd get that in there, and that's a little piece from the Negative Land release Dyspepsy, which combined Negative Land's normal cut-up anti-corporate activist musical artwork with bits and pieces from Pepsi advertising material. Bernie S., I believe you you actually met Richard Lyons a while back.
Oh, yeah, a good 10 years ago, Negative Land was performing here in Philadelphia. And I met them after the show, and we hung out and went out to dinner. And it was just really, it was fascinating meeting with these guys who had done all this just amazing anti-corporate cut-up stuff that became very popular, much to the dismay of the corporations who they were lampooning. But we stopped at one club, and Richard noted that that almost all the folks there were born before their first popular album. So they realized they were getting up in age. But Richard was only 57 when he passed away this past week. So this is really a sad and untimely loss of a great artist.
Indeed it is. Negative Land, of course, might be familiar to Hope attendees. They presented at H2K2 in 2002. We had Mark Hosler from Negative Land presenting some of Negative Land's music and films and things of that sort. They've been friends of the show. I believe Mark actually joined us on the show a couple of times some years back. You can find those in our archives on 2600.com. So the work of Negative Land has always been brilliant, and Richard Lyons will be missed. The world is poorer for his loss, I believe.
It has not been a good week for talented musicians.
Indeed it hasn't. Richard Lyons passed away, Prince passed away, earlier this year David Bowie passed away, and it's not been a good year for sort of people of legendary standing in the field of musical entertainment and art. So, the rest of you, if you're in this line of work and you do clever work like this, maybe go take your physical, take some vitamins, do what you have to do to take care of yourself.
Yes.
But beyond that...
I have no good segue off of that, but a lot of other things are happening in the world.
There is no good segue, but I'd like to think Mr. Lyons would approve of there being no good segue from that.
Findface, have you heard of it?
Findface, I have not heard of it.
Findface is a piece of software that was developed, and apparently what it can do is if you have a photograph of someone, say someone that you meet or just surreptitiously snap on the street or a good friend of yours, anyone, you can upload it to this service, Findface. And it searches the Russian social network VKontakte, and I apologize, there's some Russian words in this, I'm going to mispronounce all of them. And it searches the entire database of this large social network, or at least a large portion of the database, I don't know how exactly it works, and applies a facial recognition algorithm. So if you want to find someone, you can do it using their face. I don't know if you've read this story, Rob, but what do you think paragraph 2 of this story is going to say?
Oh, I think it's going to be something just cementing this as a valuable tool and something that can well serve humanity in general.
I thought you had been on this radio program longer than to make that guess. Instead, what people are doing is... They're identifying and harassing Russian women who appear in pornography. On April 9th, which is just 3 days after the Russian media reported on this project users of the Russian image board Dvach, again, apologies, launched a campaign to de-anonymize actresses who appear in pornography. So it takes they're taking, I guess, a still from the films and identifying them with Fine Face, and then making a copy of the V-Contacted pages so that even if they then take their pages down, it's spamming the women's families and friends with messages informing them about the discovery, and on and on. I don't know why this wasn't a foreseen consequence. People on the internet will do anything to harass people, women in particular. I don't know if there's a lesson here, but other than don't make services that can identify people who don't want to be identified.
Mike?
Yeah.
I just want to point out some of our listeners who might want to, who may be curious if a picture of their face is on findface.com. If you upload your picture, they will have it and they will certainly store it, yeah, and they will use it again in the future for who knows what. So be careful about whose faces you upload to Fine Face, including also Facebook and other social media applications and services. Once you put your picture online like that, it will stay online and be potentially abused forever.
Speaking to the website T-Journal, the founder of FineFace, whose name is Maxim Perlin, said there's no way he can prevent people from using his service to harass women in this way. Here's a way he could take down the service. I can't think of a single legitimate use for this service, although maybe I just lack imagination.
Well, obviously you're not harassing enough celebrities or I mean, I'm not going to judge your hobbies. If you don't want to harass celebrities with the rest of us, that's perfectly fine. But
is there something you're trying to tell me here, Rob? The rest of us harassing people.
Well, I'm...
I mean, it's important to know that many of the harassed people are not that famous.
Of course. And, you know, everyone is at risk. When you put information online, you're not just sharing it with your small, enclosed group of people who have you added on some social network. You are in essence, posting it to the entire world.
I think you're right. But yeah. But I think to blame this entirely on the users and say you shouldn't upload to this service... I think the greater part of the responsibility falls on the makers of these services to protect their users' privacy.
Of course, and I'm not blaming the victims here. It's a sad reality of the media environment in which we find ourselves that, everything you put out there is just out there for anyone to use for any reason they can think up. And so, you know, I'm not judging the people who do certain types of work or, you know, have certain types of hobbies, as long as they're not being jerks to people like abusers of this service. But, you know, it's out there, and I don't think we can quite depend on anyone apart from ourselves to keep information like this or resources like this, like pictures of ourselves, in a quote unquote safe place. And I say this as somebody with way too many pictures of himself on the internet.
And you take many steps to avoid photographs of you being on the internet, and yet there are a lot. For normal people.
Well, you know, pictures of me, there are very few normal people in those, but...
Right, right.
But still.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know. I've never met any normal people. I don't know. I actually know how they live their lives, but...
Normal people are actually very rare, I believe. Yeah. But, there's... There's something else to think about. There's a story comes from Vice that in a first, a judge has thrown out evidence obtained from FBI malware.
Yeah.
Yeah. This story came out on the 20th. For the first time, a judge has actually thrown out evidence obtained via FBI malware. The move comes from a case affected by the FBI seizure of a dark web child pornography site in February 2015 and the subsequent deployment of a network investigative technique, which is the agency's term for a hacking tool, in order to identify the site's visitors. But basically, they gathered a bunch of data, and they gathered it outside of the normal accepted legal framework of such things. And the court actually concluded that the warrant was issued without jurisdiction and thus was void, and the collected evidence was therefore inadmissible. So it's kind of strange, because this was a court... excuse me.
Yeah.
This was a court that took this outlook on something the FBI has done. A spokesperson for the Department of Justice sent the statement. This is Peter Carr. Sent the statement, "We are disappointed with the court's decision and are reviewing our options. The decision highlights why the government supports the clarification of the rules of procedure currently pending before the Supreme Court to ensure that criminals using sophisticated anonymizing technologies to conceal their identities while they engage in crime over the internet are able to be identified and apprehended." But what strikes me about this is that we've seen the FBI, the NSA, all these three-letter agencies basically form the laws to their own will, and then after they've done that, fail to follow said laws and still act outside them. And that to me seems kind of bizarre. I mean, if I were able to make the rules to suit whatever I wanted to do, I would maybe make the rules that way first and then do what I wanted. Or I don't know. What do you guys think?
I mean, what we see, and I don't know, there's a few similar cases going on, so I don't know if it's this one or a related one. The government is using these. I'll let them use their term and call them investigatory techniques, although that's really glossing over the fact that they're going into other people's computers and modifying how they work without their permission. But whatever. For now, we'll call that an investigatory technique. They're using these investigatory techniques and refusing and you know, arresting people and charging them with crimes and then refusing to say how they got the evidence that they got. We've seen this before with the so-called Stingray technology, and we're seeing it now with these sort of Tor exploits, whatever it is. The government really wants to have, you know, both sides. They want to be able to use techniques, and they don't want to be able to say how they work so that defendants can't challenge them. And in cases, you know, like the U.S. government is finding people who they believe to be criminals and choosing not to prosecute them because they don't want to say how they found them. And that, you know, should be worrying from literally every perspective. If you're a law and order type, you want these people locked up. So you want the government to say what it's doing so that, you know, if the evidence is real, then it can stand. If you are a privacy type, then you really want the government to not be doing this. It's, as Rob said, they're really, you know, trying to shape the rules and just doing such a terrible job of it.
So, back on this case here, what it looks like to me is, you know, the FBI used malware, somehow got spyware on their target's computer without getting a warrant from a judge to do so, got information off their target's computer using this malware, and tried to admit that illegally obtained evidence with in a court, and the judge, William Young of the District of Massachusetts, I think he deserves a lot of credit for noting that this was a violation of someone's Fourth Amendment rights against unwarranted, unlawful search and seizure. And he said, since warrantless searches are presumptively unreasonable and the good faith exception is inapplicable, the evidence must be excluded. So this was a suppression motion from the defense, and a good one, I think. And I'm glad that I hope this just teaches a lesson to the FBI, although they seem to have not learned from a lot of other lessons in the past. But I hope they, being called to task for this, that they will reduce their doing this, although I don't have high hopes that'll happen.
Right. And it's very easy to point to, especially a case like this that involves child pornography, and just point at it and say, well, how could you be defending people who've done something like that? But the point is that they are not yet proven to have done something like that, and we are ostensibly an innocent until proven guilty society. And if the rights don't apply to the accused in this case, then they won't apply to the accused in your own case, whether it be for something earth-shattering or something minor. But
let's be clear. The government here is deliberately sabotaging its own prosecutions because it doesn't want to say how it does what it does.
Right, because they don't want to follow their own rules that they make for themselves.
So I don't, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for the victims of these people, you know, assuming they're guilty, that they're not going to see justice. But let's be clear about whose fault that these people are remaining free. So,
right. Terrible things are very easy to use as excuses for even more terrible things in the guise of defense.
And it's also worth pointing out that the FBI and other law enforcement agencies have been caught in the past countless times, illegally obtaining evidence, electronic evidence. And then sometimes they're smarter about not trying to admit it, but will go through it, fish through it, and find something that will give them leads illegally. And then they'll use some other pretext to say they got this other information legally when they have this investigative advantage that was obtained illegally. So it would not surprise me if this is going on a wide scale. This is just a rare case where the FBI actually was stupid enough to try to admit illegally obtained evidence, and they got slapped down by the judge. So, listen, it's all our rights that are at risk here. It doesn't matter how bad the person is, allegedly is, that the target was. Once our rights start disappearing, it's going to happen. It could have happened to any of us. So that's why it's important to pay attention to these cases, I think.
And it's something that we've seen happen many times already, even in just recent memory. And once you give up a right, no matter what the reasons are, it's very difficult to ever see it come back.
Indeed.
So where are Kyle and Emmanuel this evening?
Kyle and Emmanuel, they are still away on assignment, on a top secret mission. They're in an undisclosed location somewhere in the Adirondacks, I believe. Yeah, if you're climbing any mountains at this point, look around. You might see our friends there. But they've been on a long and winding journey, and I'm sure we're going to hear all about it when they get back. And I look forward to it. I look forward to the tales of their adventures.
So they're out of telephone range, mobile telephone range. Is that the case?
That would appear to be the case. We were going to work out something where they would contact us if they could and join us tonight, but. That has not happened, so I'm going to assume that they're somewhere out of cell phone range, and there's maybe a horror movie about to break out or something.
Well, I wish they'd remembered to bring their satellite phones on this trip.
Yeah, we really should stop hiding those from them, no matter how fun it is.
So we've talked a lot about ad blockers on this program, something you don't have to use for our program because we don't have ads. But
indeed,
if you browse a lot of the rest of the web, you might see an ad, and you might want to... You just might not want to look at the ad, but you might also be more concerned with the privacy implications of having these random third-party ad tracking companies run software on your computer, so you might have an ad blocker. And if the website you're visiting has a lot of people with ad blockers and they want revenue, then they might deploy an ad blocker to tempt you from visiting their website with your ad blocker installed. But... there's some interesting news out of Europe, which is that the European Commission says that browser-side web scripts that pick out advert blockers may be accessing people's personal data, such as the plugin, which is stored on your computer, and you can only do such data access in the European Union if you have permission from the user in question. This is the same rule that causes those annoying... pop-ups that you see about cookies if you ever have visited a website in Europe.
Absolutely.
That applies to being in Europe and visiting a website, and also to being elsewhere and visiting a website when the website is in Europe. I imagine most people who run ad blockers do not want to give permission to run ad blocker detection. So under EU law in force, people must give their consent before the anti-ad blocker script can run and hide content on a page. So some interesting rulings from the European Commission will continue to follow that and see if it actually is enforced or not.
Yeah, I'm very interested to see how this shakes out, because we know now about clicking OK or dismissing the notices about cookies from European sites. But are we now going to have to dismiss a message asking us permission to see if we have an ad blocker so they can pester us to block our ad blocker and reveal their ads or not? I mean, the sort of arms race between advertisers and ad blockers has always been kind of fascinating, but this kind of puts a new spin on it. Of course, browsers give up a ton of information about you just every time you visit a site, from your IP address and things like that, to the configuration of your own browser, what browser you're using, what operating system you're using, the size of your screen, what fonts you have installed. All kinds of things are just transferred in the normal course of your web browsing, unless you're taking sort of extreme measures to keep that info private. So it's going to be definitely interesting to see where this goes. What do you think, Bernie?
I think the arms race will only continue between advertisers, online advertisers, and technologies used to block those ads, and the methods used by advertisers to peel layers off of our anonymity to see who we are so they can track us, and between technologies used to prevent that. It is never going to stop. It's really, you know, we're at the infancy of this stuff. This stuff really only started maybe, 15, 20 years ago, the cookies and things like that. But it just boggles my mind to think where we're going to be in another 10, 15, 20 years with all this spy, counter-spy type stuff. It's who do you think's going to win?
I think the maybe start a company that makes both ads and ad blockers, so you'll be
that's been done, Rob. You're joking, but for a long time the most popular ad blocker was AdBlock Plus, and they now accept bribes from advertisers to show you ads. This is the kind of thing I would make up as a joke, but I promise you, it's true.
There really are no original ideas anymore,
no,
are there?
None.
Especially when it comes to sort of being creepy and evil to people over the internet.
Well, in that case, unfortunately, it seems that there are new ideas being come up with all the time, but I struggle to know how it's still possible as well.
Speaking of hidden creepy things, a story just came out today. This is from Reuters, I think. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists is about to unleash a huge data dump of additional data from the Panama Papers leaks. They're going to release this on May 9th, and the ICIJ said in an email statement that they'll, quote, publish what will likely be the largest ever release of information about secret offshore companies and the people behind them based on data from the Panama Papers investigation. The searchable database will include information about more than 200,000 companies, trusts, foundations, and funds incorporated in 21 tax havens from Hong Kong to Nevada and the United States. I'm normally not one to get all that excited about announcements of technical things, you know, a month before the fact or so. But this caught my interest. This, I think, will be worth keeping an eye on.
This is a lot of data. I'm trying to remember from earlier stories about this. It was several terabytes of data. That's several thousand gigabytes.
Yep.
of data that was. Obtained surreptitiously from this law firm in Panama, which specializes in helping people hide their riches. And we've already seen the Prime Minister of Iceland resign over this because he was apparently using the same people.
Is he still resigned? Do you know? He resigned, then he unresigned, then I think he resigned again. I can't keep track.
Good point.
I think at this point he's standing halfway in the doorway of the office, like refusing to go one way or the other.
It's like a quantum resignation to make.
People are trying to kick him out. Right. But he was basically cut using services of some of the same companies that brought the Icelandic economy into a practical depression a few years ago, and that did not go over well with the Icelandic populace, so they want him out. And I don't think anybody could possibly have gone through these terabytes of data yet and found every instance of these people that are trying to hide their money, so we don't know they've maybe stolen tax money or whatever. But in any case, this is going to be interesting. I think we can use crowdsourcing for a lot of people to start calling through all this data when it's released, so that there's going to be a lot of secrets that are unearthed, and I'm guessing that a lot of rich and powerful people are going to be very red-faced or worse by this.
Yeah, I mean, it's this is just one law firm, and I imagine, I guess they're fairly large, but by no means the only law firm in this space. So there must be a lot of very wealthy people very relieved that they chose a different law firm to handle their shady affairs.
Right. According to the article I have here, over 11 million documents held by this law firm, which is a Panama-based law firm, Mossack Fonseca, would have been leaked to a German newspaper, which shared the information with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, who are the ones collectively combing through 11 million documents. They've already been through, it looks like, about 28,000 pages of them. That's resulted in the info that's come out so far. And it's really just the tip of the iceberg. So
they've just scratched the surface on these millions of documents. So I think it's good that this is going to be released to the public so that a lot of people can use crowdsourcing efforts to go through these documents. And I also want to point out something I pointed out on the show three weeks ago, is that we would never know about this leak. It wouldn't even be a leak, I think, if the person who surreptitiously obtained this important data didn't use good encryption tools to communicate with a German newspaper reporter, a news media reporter. They went through a lot of pains, the source and the reporter, to ensure that they were using secure encryption technology to get all this information transferred from the source to the reporter, because the source said he believed his life was in danger. If his identity became known, he thought he would be dead. So this is another reason why secure encryption is really important to everyone. Without secure encryption, leaks of important information that we should know about probably aren't going to happen, because people don't want to be found out. Sometimes people just want to leak stuff anonymously.
It is pretty vital to the whole process. I mean, whistleblowing has been long established as something that's important and vital and should be protected. So many really important things have come out through the work of whistleblowers. And if you're going to do that now, you need to take certain measures, because there are the sort of big name whistleblowers who have been caught and made examples of, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, people like that. They have set an example, but I don't think the example that the authorities wanted. The authorities would rather everyone be too scared to do what they do. But now we could see how they were caught, and we can see that it's actually fairly easy to get the right tools together and the right procedures together to avoid getting caught as they did.
I mean, I also have a lot of respect for people who chose to act in the open, as Snowden did and Manning sort of did. I think the option to be anonymous or not is important.
Absolutely, and it's a decision that everyone has to make for themselves, and now it's a decision that can be made sort of with all the available data, with the right tools available, and keeping those available is vital to the whole process, I think.
So, Rob, if you worked for a government agency or a big corporation, and you saw something that was really wrong happening, something illegal, something highly unethical, and you felt like you needed to do something about it, and if you felt, as Edward Snowden reportedly did, that going through official channels would just get him in a lot of trouble, like happened to Bill Binney and Thomas Drake and others, for going through official channels. You could be tempted to want to release this information anonymously to a reporter. And the only way to really do that is through encryption. It's one method. It's very difficult to share information electronically and preserving your anonymity. That's why I think it's important that we keep this going. Are there any updates on this crazy Ross Feinberg bill that's been floating around? Mike, do you know anything about that?
I don't have any updates. I'm not sure which bill you mean.
The so-called anti-encryption bill that...
From Senator Feinstein.
Feinstein, I'm not
and,
Feinberg.
And Burr.
Feinstein,
yeah.
Ross
yeah.
Feinstein, yes.
Senator Feingold is on the record as opposing it, much to his credit. I haven't heard any updates.
Okay. Well, it's. I'm sure we won't hear the last of it, and we should be paying attention to it.
Right. And this is, of course, the sort of thing we're often trying to get the word out about at our Hope conferences, the next one of which is ever closer. It's only less than a few months away, maybe 2.5 months away from now. It's going to be
soon.
Yeah, it's very soon. I mean, we should really get to work behind the scenes and start getting things done. No, of course, we've been working very hard behind the scenes, and we're very proud of what we're doing. There are really exciting things that I can't say anything about because they're not public yet, but I'm excited about them, and I'll tell you that. The fact that I am indeed excited. And you know, some great stuff's going to happen. If you're not familiar, go to hope.net, H-O-P-E.net, get all the information. It's coming up in July, Midtown Manhattan, right at the Hotel Pennsylvania, our home from home. And there's going to be some really cool stuff going on. Our keynote speaker, Cory Doctorow, has been announced. All sorts of other really good talks in the works. Our friends of Radio Statler have announced that their panel is going to be happening this time. They're going to be doing a panel as well as running the radio station that they run every 2 years at the conference.
Well, they do both at the same time.
Very, very trickily, I imagine. But if there's one thing that crew can do, it's keep a lot of balls in the air at once. And I look forward to seeing how they do it. We actually got an email from somebody interested in volunteering who can't actually make it to the conference, but wanted to know if there are ways they can volunteer online outside the conference. And if anyone's interested in volunteering, whether at the conference or in other ways, go to hope.net and click on the volunteers page. All the info is there for you and the contact info. Or you can email volunteers@hope.net because it is a major event. We do need all the help we can get. And we totally appreciate anyone who wants to give us a hand with things. So, yes, volunteers@hope.net. We're also still accepting proposals for talks and things. If you haven't gotten yours in yet, get it in damn soon. Go to hope.net, click the speakers page, and the info is there. If you've got ideas for workshops, again, go to hope.net. The info is there for you. And let us know what workshops you could do, what workshops you would like to see, maybe that you yourself can't do but would want to attend. All this because that's what the event is for. It's for the things that that are important to the people who go to the event. And before and behind the scenes, where we want to make this, as we do every couple of years, I think, we want to make this one the best one yet. So, yeah, take a look. Speaking of Hope, I did mention that Negative Land presented it. Want to find that. If you want to watch that whole presentation, it's worth going to Channel 2600 on YouTube and bringing it up that way, because they presented some films and things which do have the visual element to them. So if you want to watch them on YouTube, you can search for it there. Or if you just want to get hold of the MP3, you can get that from the Hope website. And that and tons more topics that I can't even begin to list here, because we would be here all night. Bernie, what are you thinking about this Hope so far, this upcoming Hope?
Well, I am privy to some information that has made me very excited as well. And
you're really selling this, guys.
well, I know. This is very teasing, but we just can't blow it for some of our speakers and other things without releasing information in the right way. But we will be doing it very soon. There's just some really great talks coming down, talks and panels coming down the pipeline, and some great workshops as well. Mitch Altman is doing a great job, along with Tech Darko, putting together the workshops part of Hope, which has really grown a lot over the past few years, where, you know, you don't just sit back and listen to a speaker. You go into a room with a speaker and do something hands-on with whatever they're talking about, and whether it's building some electronic device or writing code or workshops on how to fill out a Freedom of Information request to your favorite government agency to find out what they know about this or that. There are going to be a lot of interesting workshops and talks and panels and projects and music and all kinds of stuff for 3 days, July 22nd, 23rd, 24. So like Rob said, check out hope.net. And I think during the months of April and May, is that right?
I think it's just April.
Just the month of April. Yeah. So before the end of this month, if you go to hope.net, if you obtain a ticket online, 10% of the proceeds will go to support the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who is which is an amazing organization that really helps all of us in the hacker community. And they will be doing presenting some talks and panels at the 11th Hope as well. Probably have a table. They are defending our rights in on the internet and in other electronic ways, electronic mediums. So it's very important we support them. We had their, I think their chief general counsel just on the air here three weeks ago, and they're fighting a good fight for us, because if they don't do this, there aren't a lot of other organizations, maybe the ACLU, but they're not as skilled from a technology standpoint quite as or practice as the EFF is, but they're very good as well. But there aren't a lot of legal organizations that are defending people's rights in this electronic realm, so it's really important that we support the groups that do.
Right, and yeah, only a few days left, actually, to help support the EFF with your Hope ticket. So yeah, hope.net, all the info is on there. Other stuff going on. It's you might have heard something about this if you listen to or read a kind of decent amount of news. There's kind of an election going on in this country. Yeah,
is it still going on? Do you know that this election won't be over until the summer hasn't even started? The summer's going to be over. It's going to be fall and miserable weather again before this thing is over. That's how long this is going.
Yeah, and it just feels longer with every story that comes out of it. But last week we were talking a little bit about the local elections here in New York City and how things weren't working. People were finding themselves deleted from rosters and things like that. The day after our program on Thursday, a story came out that a New York City Board of Elections official has been suspended after voting issues arose in Brooklyn during the primary election the preceding Tuesday. The Commissioner's Executive Committee of the Board of Elections voted to suspend Borough Office Chief Clerk Diane Hazlett Rudiano, that's an interesting sentence to say, without pay. And the suspension takes effect immediately because apparently things were actually that bad and they're acknowledging it. So maybe this is a little reassuring to people who had a hard time of it last week, that things will be in complete working order and entirely fixed by the time the actual election and not just the primaries come along. I don't know.
Sure hope so. Last night, Rob, I was at a what I was hoping would be a Bernie Sanders victory party here in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. Unfortunately, he did not win the Pennsylvania primary, but I did meet up with a whole lot of Bernie Sanders campaign volunteers last night after we were trying to get out to vote, and one of them is a delegate, Democrat Party delegate for Bernie Sanders. Her name is Carmen, and I had a really good conversation with her about this these voting irregularities in polling irregularities. In New York, and she's involved with things up in New York to ensure this investigation goes the way it should and is really taken seriously, and that these things will be rectified prior to the November general election. So I'm glad we got good people out there working on this, but it's really inexplicable how this could have happened in the first place. It's just, you know.
Did you vote, Bernie?
I absolutely did.
Any stories to tell?
Well, there was a moderately good turnout. It was a wonderful, it was a beautiful day weather-wise here in Philadelphia.
I wasn't really looking for weather-related stories.
But what I mean is that's linked to the turnout.
Yeah, it's true.
Poor weather results in low turnout, and some candidates do especially well when there's a good turnout, and some candidates do especially well when there's not a good turnout. So that is, it is relevant, I think. But yeah, aside from the weather report, there was a good turnout. A surprising number of young people at the voting precinct where I went, and there were no problems. I was able to just sign without showing any ID, and they looked at my signature and it matched, and they escorted me into a booth for people who registered as Democrats, and I used the giant membrane keyboard, reminiscent of the Atari 400, with this little bendable, clickable buttons underneath this giant membrane with candidates and delegates and other things and referenda. You know, you press them and there's a red LED lights up behind it, and then I press the big vote button at the bottom, and it allegedly records my vote. But what happens in that black box is anybody's guess. I hope my vote was counted, but I have no way of verifying.
I think what happens is if you press the right series of light-up buttons, a peanut will come out the bottom, and NASA will know whether they can send you to space.
Ah, you know, there's probably Easter eggs. These voting machines, these electronic voting machines, probably do have Easter eggs built into them.
I would design Easter eggs into such a thing if that were my job. That's probably why that's not my job. But yeah, a lot going on. We have a little bit of time left. I want to see if maybe we can take some phone calls today. Give us a call at 1-718-780-8888. While we're waiting for the board to light up, I'll read the short story we've got about Microsoft and Google have agreed to end all regulatory complaints against each other. They've, in a statement to the site Recode, Google and Microsoft said that the companies should be competing on products instead of focusing on legal proceedings. Their companies compete vigorously, but they want to do so on the merits of their product, not in legal proceedings, from a statement from Google. So it's, if you're familiar with Tom and Jerry cartoons in the 1970s when they were suddenly friends for no reason, instead of chasing one another, I think it feels a bit like that. But
this is collusion, right? There's no other word for this.
Right. It's Alien versus Predator. Whoever wins, we lose, I think. But how's that switchboard looking?
It's blinking. There's a lot of tape on it, so I can only press some of the buttons maybe, but I'll press this one and wish you a good evening and tell you you're on the air.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I'm calling with a complaint about Election Day. I'm in Richmond Hill, Queens, and we got to the poll place at 8 o'clock in the morning. The guy at our table said that in 10 years of being the polling supervisor, he had gotten 3 complaints, you know, 3 times when he had to fill out the affidavit in 10 years. We got there at 8 o'clock. The polls were open for 2 hours. We were the 153rd persons to fill out an affidavit. We were all struck from the books, and we voted there twice before.
So wow. It sounds like
that makes you feel
normal. Yeah.
Well, you just feel as if you're, like, stripped of your citizenship, and these are supposed to be our people in our town, and all of a sudden we're exiled from our town, we're stripped of our rights. It's terrible. It's un-American.
So are you feeling like they'll have everything fixed by the time the proper election comes along?
Good luck.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it. Thank you very much for
your
call.
All right, thank you, brother.
Thanks for the call. They're supposed to follow up with you and let you know the results of your affidavit. So I hope they do that in this caller's case. Maybe he can let us know
if they've got that working.
While we wait for more people to call us, 718-780-8888. This story from Kuwait. Kuwait is going to DNA test everyone in the entire country, including all tourists arriving at the airport.
Well,
or DNA tag, I guess. This story from News 24, which I'm not familiar with, but they cite the Kuwait Times. The DNA testing law is aimed at creating an integrated security database, the first of its kind in the world, and the DNA tagging will only be used for criminal security purposes. I don't know if that means they want to commit crimes with this database or what, but scary stuff. And Kuwait, I'm sure, it's just the test bed. I'm sure other lands will be doing it too.
So wait, if you go to Kuwait soon when they start this program, after they start this program, they will be sampling your DNA and storing it, you know, indefinitely and using it in ways that you have no idea how they're really, really going to be using it. I mean,
that's
and then what governments? What governments is the United States government an ally of Kuwait, providing them with resources and arms and things. So can we expect Kuwait to share this DNA data collected from people with other countries' intelligence agencies?
I mean, I'm sure anything that the Kuwaiti government has, the U.S. intelligence agencies can get through cooperation or otherwise. But I was not able to find a lot of information about what specifically they're collecting or what they're going to do with what they say they're going to do with the data. But definitely we'll keep our eye on it and look for more details as they come out. We've got some more people calling in, only a short time to talk to them. So good evening. You're on the air. Hello?
Hello. Yeah, this is Joel calling from New Jersey. I'm listening to your program on WBAI. I wanted to make a comment.
Please do.
On election integrity.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Yeah. Okay. we've been following this issue, and I'm in contact with people who've written books on it, like Jonathan Simons' Code Red and Mark Crispin Miller, who's written books on the theft of the 2000-2004 election. My great conundrum is why there has been very little press investigation about the kind of behind-the-scenes vote counting, the computerized vote hacking. They do a lot on the laws that are passed that restrict voting. This you see in the New York Times, but you will not see how votes are flipped. We have Bob Fitrakis working on this in Ohio. And I always wondered why the Democratic Party wasn't onto this, since these things seem to favor Republicans and give us what we call a rolling coup d'etat with governorships, legislatures out in many states like Wisconsin and Illinois, and the U.S. Congress going over to Republicans, even though they're very much a minority party. And now, with this election, and Hillary being the establishment candidate, taking money from the big guys, from the deep state actors, the 1%, the oligarchy, call it what you will, and Bernie contesting this, we're starting to see this happen to Bernie. We've seen it. It's been documented by the Washington Post in Sussex County, Delaware, for example, in isolated places. But it's just very strange to see him coming out with these results. And now, of course, we have the disappearing registrations in Brooklyn, and your last caller who reported so many irregularities going on. So we seem to see the reason why the Democrats won't investigate these shady practices, really illegal practices, and it indicates that they're doing it themselves, and we need some good investigative reporting to go to the heart of the matter.
All right. Thanks for that suggestion. We'll definitely keep an eye on these sorts of things as they continue.
Okay, we're not going to get it from the New York Times.
All right. Well,
that's why we need, among other things, this place, WBAI, and we'll try and do our best with what we've got here. Thank you very much for your call.
Yeah. I think this phone is acting up very strangely. I don't know what all this tape means, but I have no blinking lights to press. It's pretty sad. 718-780-8888 is our number.
I could actually use some tape, so maybe I should grab some of that on the
way
out later.
Plenty on this phone, I'll tell you that. I don't want to remove it because it'll probably fall apart. But,
but yeah, 718-780-8888. I'll quickly mention there's a very good opinion column on the site DW.com by someone named Kathleen Schuster, which is titled, "Why Isn't the NSA a Hot Topic in the U.S. Elections?" Which is an important question to ask, and the answers apparently are very myriad and subtle, and the piece itself is an eye-opener. We don't really have sufficient time to go into it, but look it up.
It's from Deutsche Welle.
On DW,
yep.
I mean Deutsche Welle, deutschewelle.com, and just search NSA and U.S. elections, and you can find it. But it really is an interesting article about why the NSA doesn't seem to be a hot topic in U.S. elections, although Senator Bernie Sanders has come out and said he's against the domestic surveillance here in the United States by NSA. And Hillary Clinton has said she thinks we need a balance between security and privacy. So, but that doesn't seem to be, I had thought, months ago this is going to be a front and center topic. It was. How many months ago, Mike, wasn't this like a really important topic that a lot of candidates were talking about and it just sort of disappeared?
I don't really know how mainstream politics work, but maybe our listeners do, or maybe they have something else to say. Let's try it out either way. Good evening.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I don't want to go on the air with this.
Well, you're on the air right now, so if you don't want to talk to us, you've called the wrong number.
No. All right. I made a contribution on February 4th with the Hope 10 conference thumb drive, and I still have not received it.
Uh-huh. All right. Okay, this is important. Send us an email, if you haven't already, to oth@2600.com with the details of your order, the order numbers and such, if you've got that available, the name and address on the order, because we are behind in some of our previous premiums, and we are working and behind the scenes to get this all straightened out. If you've emailed us, we do have your info. We're hanging on to it, and we're working to get you what you deserve for supporting our show and our station. So we do acknowledge that things have fallen behind, and that's very unfortunate and kind of aggravating. But we are working on it.
We're trying to get information from WBAI and on what we need to provide them.
Yeah, and actually, we've got our own sort of channels that we're working in. But send us an email if you haven't already, oth@2600.com, with all the data about your order, and we will pursue this. So thank you very much for that call.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you,
and thanks again for your support. Let's try this number. Good evening. You're on the air.
I thought you might like to end with a bit more upbeat or humorous things. Are you gentlemen familiar with a film called The President's Analyst?
Oh, yes, very
much
so.
Oh, that's a great movie, yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay, so we know who the bad guy really is. And the other thing is, did you guys hear the phone booth, the drunken phone booth complaining about being abandoned? It's been on John McDonough's show.
Where was that?
Oh, okay. Go to John McDonough's show today, and he had it, and somewhere here is a note, which I've lost. There was a Arts Express. Arts Express on the 21st from 1400 to 1500 hours had it. It's a monologue by the Forgotten Phone Booth. It also has some language issues in the middle when the phone booth freaks out.
Well,
it's a phone booth from New York complaining that he's being abandoned and nobody loves him anymore.
We'll definitely check that out, and thank you very much for the pointer. The President's Analyst, definitely a good movie. If you haven't seen it, highly recommended. But yeah, we are just about out of time, so thank you very much for listening. Send us email, oth@2600.com. Stay tuned to hope.net, hope.net, for the info on the Hope Conference. And stay tuned for the Personal Computer Show following us. For Off the Hook, this is Rob T. Firefly. Have a very good night.
gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's two overpriced boxes you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag and a member card offering Zipcar sales, discounted meals at select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
Alrighty. Hey, I got a question for you. If you had $40 trillion, would you let me and my friends vote to see who is going to be president of the United States? Hey, it's Wednesday, April 27th already, 2016, 8 p.m.? What happens at 8 p.m. on Wednesday on WBAI New York 91.5 FM? Also streaming on the web at WBAI.org. I know, the personal computer show. All right, I'm Hank is here. I was wondering why you were here, Hank.
Hello, world. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and I'm in the studio in Brooklyn with Stevie Deeby. Joining us this evening, we're going to have Joe King and Michael Horowitz on remote. But before we begin, please note that our broadcast schedule for the next 2 weeks is a little different. We are preempted next week, May 4th. However, we are on the following week, May 11th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., and we have scheduled Fred Kaplan, a Pulitzer Prize journalist, to join us that evening.
That's going to be great.
Fred Kaplan has written a book titled Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. Whoa. He is a national security columnist for Slate, and he's the author of four other books. Dark Territory is a fascinating piece of reporting, and I've read it, and I had to go from beginning to end until I got to the end, and it took, it was about 300 pages. It details United States' strategic direction and actions it has taken in cyber warfare. It's quite an eye-opener. So that's on May 11th from 7 to 9 we're going to be on. And that's the schedule. And Joe?
Yeah, you know, Hank, I just want to repeat something you've already said.
Okay.
From 8 to 8:30 on May 11th, we're going to have Fred Kaplan as a guest. As you said, he's the national security columnist for Slate Online Magazine. But more than that, we're getting into a time in this world where cyber warfare is not just a science fiction theory. It's a day-to-day military operation. And this book contains an awful lot of information that I really didn't know anything about.
Yeah, it's. I have to be honest. At first I said, is this science fiction? And then he gives all the reference note, footnotes and so on. And I am familiar with some of the information. I says, wow, where did he get all this from? And he actually talked, first-hand interview with many of the people.
Indeed he did. So on May 11th from 8 to 8:30, tune in to hear Hank interview Fred Kaplan.
And Michael Horowitz, our webmaster, is also on the air with us this evening. How you doing, Michael? Yeah.
Good evening, Hank. Hopefully you can hear me.
Yes, I can hear you. I just want to tell everyone that we'll be taking the listener phone calls at the half hour. And just to remind everyone, the number is 718-780-8888, 718-780-8888. And since we're talking about security, someone who formerly worked for the NSA is working as a security expert for a startup company, and he's developed a generic, the basic form of a something that can block ransomware on the Mac. Hey, Joe, you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I think I want to hear what Michael has to say, because up till now I've always been told by people who are in the know that you don't have to worry about things like ransomware if you have a Macintosh.
Well, of course, that's not true. there's less malware on a Macintosh, but there is definitely malware. The software in question that Hank mentioned, by and large, I mean, I have a Mac computer, but I don't use it very often. The software Hank mentioned is free, which is good, but it's also brand new. I mean, it just came out. It may or may not be considered beta. And so far it's limited. There are only two known examples of ransomware on a Mac. So time will tell how we can detect the third or fourth version of ransomware that comes out.
Why is it, Michael, that there is so little, there is malware, but there is so little malware that is aimed specifically at the Macintosh?
No doubt, because there are fewer Macintosh users.
Just
that simple. Now that Apple announced their earnings yesterday, there seem to be even fewer Macintosh users.
That's not fair.
Yeah, that's not fair at all.
But, no, they announced their earnings, but they did admit that it was mainly the iPhone that was well below hoped for projections.
Well, the iPad is down, too, I believe.
No,
yes.
Yeah, the iPad, iPhone. However, the watch, however, is doing better than the original introduction of the iPad. But, you know, when your phone sales go down 27%, that's a big hit.
I heard 16%.
That's the iPad.
Well, whatever.
One was in the 20s and one was in the teens. One was the pad and one was the phone.
Whatever. Some people will say that the Macintosh operating system, OS X, is better than Windows. It's more secure. I don't believe that. I think the reason there are fewer viruses is just because there are fewer Mac users.
Yeah. Hey, you know, talking about on the operating system level, there was an announcement made by Opera, the browser company, that they're going to be implementing and having a free VPN built into the browser instead of you adding an extension to it. And I'm sort of like scratching my head and saying, why? Because you can get free VPN extensions.
Hank, before you get into that, could I ask Michael to briefly explain to us, what is a VPN?
A VPN is, in the simplest terms, it's an encrypted connection between two computers. The computer that initiates the connection is called a VPN client. The computer that receives the connection is called a VPN server. What Opera introduced is not technically a VPN. It's a good thing, possibly a very good thing, but it's not a VPN. A VPN will encrypt everything between these two computers, and there are two major benefits from having this encrypted connection. One is that anyone who's near you sees nothing but encrypted stuff coming and going from your computer. If you're on a wireless network, anyone else on the network sees nothing but encrypted stuff. You're in Starbucks or a hotel, even the nerds who work for the hotel or who work for Starbucks, all they see is you have an encrypted connection somewhere, and they can't see anything else.
Well,
the other advantage of it is you can pretend to be somewhere else because you virtually are somewhere else. Say you're in New York City and you're connected to a VPN server in Miami and you're talking to a website that's in California. The website in California thinks you're in Miami. As far as it knows, it's talking to the VPN server in Miami, and that's all it knows. So no one on the Internet can tell that you're actually in New York because your VPN connection between New York and Miami, that's hidden from the rest of the world. And this actually was a big, big deal just a few days ago with Netflix. A lot of Canadian customers in Canada don't like the fact that Netflix in Canada has a lot less stuff than Netflix does in the United States. So many of the Canadian Netflix customers have been using VPNs to pretend to be in the U.S. so they can watch more movies and TV shows. And Netflix just cracked down and is a big, it's been all over the news in Canada.
Yeah, well, how did they crack down?
They've been blocking VPNs from Canada.
But I thought that if somebody looks in, all they can do is see the encrypted data coming from the server.
Yes, but there are only so many VPN companies and only so many VPN servers, and I suspect Netflix is just blocking them individually.
Well, let me ask then, with Opera, where it's going to be built into the browser, how would they block that?
Well, they have to determine the Opera VPN servers, where they're located.
Okay.
And then they block all access from those particular computers.
You know, since there are...
Now, wait a minute. They don't block anything. They have to block everything. If they either block or they don't block. They can't just block Netflix connected. They have to block email.
No, this is something Netflix has done. Netflix is starting. Now, I mean, there are 300 companies providing VPNs. I don't think Netflix is blocking all 300 of them. But they're blocking perhaps the most popular ones.
What I'm suggesting is they're not just blocking Netflix from that VPN. They have to block everything from that VPN.
Well, I'm not sure who the they is you're referring to.
The ISP.
Oh, no, the ISP is not involved at all.
Oh, it's just Netflix.
No, it's just a Netflix thing. Yeah.
No, where's the source?
I see.
Netflix was tired of the Canadians cheating and seeing movies that are licensed in the U.S. that are not licensed in Canada.
Well, we got a clarification on that.
I mean, now that said, the Opera, although it's not a full VPN, what the Opera VPN, it does, it is a good thing, but it only encrypts stuff that's leaving your web browser. So if you're running Skype, that's not encrypted. If you're using Outlook for email, that's not encrypted. Opera only encrypts stuff in the browser, and of course, if you're running Firefox, that's not encrypted either.
You're saying it just encrypts Opera stuff.
And even then, it only encrypts most Opera stuff, not all Opera stuff.
For now.
Now, that said, it is free, and it is encrypting, and it is hiding your IP address, and you don't even have to sign up. You don't need a user ID and password. It's built into the browser.
Well, I think the main thing is...
it is a good thing.
Michael, if I was sitting in my neighborhood Starbucks or my neighborhood Mac that also offers it, would that protect me from using their open ISP?
By and large, yes, it will.
So there's a tremendous use to it just for that, if for nothing else. You're sitting in the airport. You don't want to worry about identity theft. You can use this.
Well, I was going to make the comment that...
It's not as good as a VPN, but it's certainly way better than nothing.
I was going to make the comment that if it's built in, it's one less step for the average user, because if you have to add extensions or plugins and so on, they tend not to do it, but if it's built in, they may use it.
Yes, it absolutely wins on ease of use.
Hmm. Hey, by the way, there was something that the House, you know, normally when we talk about pending bills, I don't like to talk about it until it becomes, you know, it's passed and the president signs off on it. But this one, when you see something come out of a subcommittee with a 28-0 vote, you say, wow. And you say, what is it? It's they're updating the 1986 Electronic Communication Privacy Act, which allowed the government to access emails of Americans by only issuing a